Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen, who examines the slash-and-burn cuts in President Trump's proposed federal budget and the national campaign being waged to defeat it in Congress. Activists Erica Faircloth, Valerie Williams, and Marvin Winstead, who explained why they opposed the Atlantic Coast Pipeline just before they began a 15-day, 200-mile protest walk across North Carolina. And Jay Reistenberg of Common Cause, who discusses the organizations and funding behind a nationwide effort to convene an Article 5 constitutional convention that could jeopardize Americans' rights and protections. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Small farmers from the Bajo Aguan Valley in Honduras have sued a branch of the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, or IFC, for bankrolling the Dinant Corporation, which is being blamed for attacks and killings over disputed land. The class action suit, filed on behalf of 15 plaintiffs of the Honduran-Panama community, was filed in Washington, D.C., home of the World Bank, by lawyers from Earth Rights International. The group filed a similar suit against the IFC on behalf of Indian farmers over pollution generated by a coal-fired power plant, which was later dismissed. According to the Guardian newspaper, the 132-page complaint seeks compensation for murder, torture, assault, unjust enrichment, and other acts of aggression. Earth Rights lawyers say the case is about the IFC and the World Bank knowingly profiting from financing of murder. The suit also charges that Dinant, which has vast palm oil plantations in the Bajo Aguan Valley, hired hitmen, military forces, and private security services to intimidate and kill local farmers. Amid calls by the Trump administration for deep cuts to the United Nations, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson warned that the United States may pull out of the U.N. Human Rights Council unless the body carries out considerable reforms. Tillerson's stark warning came in a letter to American human rights and humanitarian groups obtained by Foreign Policy magazine. Sources inside the State Department say there is no current plan to pull out of the UN Human Rights Council, which last year voted to require the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to create a database of companies doing business with Israeli settlements. Tillerson expressed skepticism of the 47-member Human Rights Council, whose members include chronic human rights violators like China, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. The George W. Bush administration refused to join the council when it was established in 2006 over concerns about harsh criticism of Israel. The Obama administration joined the council in 2009 and used its seat to pursue rights abuse cases in North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and against extremist groups like ISIS and Boko Haram. A move to pull out of the council is strongly opposed by humanitarian advocates and activists who are concerned that it would diminish the U.S. role on human rights in the Trump era. 20 years after the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled that restricting minority students to non-white schools denies them of their right to an equal education, Hartford has revamped its educational system to emphasize diversity, even after the failures of mandatory busing in the 1970s and 80s. Now Hartford families have the choice of going to a magnet school, a neighborhood school, or attending a school in a neighboring district. Today, nearly half of Hartford's public school students are enrolled in integrated schools, as opposed to 10% of students in 2003. A landmark lawsuit in 1989, led by plaintiff Milo Sheff, a 13-year-old African-American who attended an all-minority school, demonstrated how Hartford students lacked equal educational opportunity. In 1996, the state Supreme Court ruled racial segregation, intentional or not, deprived school children of a substantially equal educational opportunity. In 2003, the state reached a settlement with the plaintiffs whereby Hartford and surrounding communities would run regional magnet schools open to all through a lottery system. Over the next decade, the state of Connecticut spent over $1.4 billion on magnet school construction and rehabilitation. Hartford schools, which enroll suburban children, have improved the academic achievement of both Black and Hispanic students. Similar research at the national level has found merit in busing programs. A long-term study of Black adults who as children were subject to court-ordered desegregation programs reported significant gains, including higher earnings and better health, compared with Blacks who didn't attend integrated schools. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Donald Trump's first formal budget proposal to Congress, unveiled on March 16th, is one of the most extreme of any president in recent history. The White House proposal, dubbed the America First Budget, increases defense spending by $54 billion and offsets increased funding of the military with reductions to non-defense spending, including deep cuts for education, environmental protection, health and human services, and foreign aid. The proposed budget appears to follow a philosophy laid out by Trump's chief strategist, white nationalist Steve Bannon, who declared that the new administration is in a battle to deconstruct the administrative state. Trump's budget blueprint, many parts of which have been taken directly from proposals made by the right-wing Heritage Foundation, call for the elimination of hundreds of programs and agencies, with more than 50 within the Environmental Protection Agency alone. Programs identified for termination include public broadcasting, legal aid, and the arts. Critics charge that the budget is a blatant attack on the nation's most vulnerable, deeply cutting programs that primarily benefit the poorest Americans, such as heating assistance, Meals on Wheels for homebound seniors, and low-income housing. Your reporter spoke with Lisa Gilbert, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for Public Citizen, and chair of the Clean Budget Coalition. Here she examines the negative consequences of President Trump's proposed slash-and-burn federal budget and the national campaign being waged to defeat it in Congress.
As scary as it is, the Trump budget is just a proposed budget, and the president's budget is usually kind of a wish list where they try to throw out their own ideological ideas, and in this case, his idea is to slash and burn. So as scary as the concepts contained in this are, we have a lot of hope that Congress will push back because even many in the GOP find this budget far too extreme. And so it's unlikely we'll see something exactly like this when it comes time to create the FY18 budget. That said, it is a scary one. He dubbed it America First, which is terrifying when we think about all the things that will now be last, from protecting our environment to protecting our safety. There are cuts across the board for what we call non-defense discretionary spending, which is just a fancy term for really everything domestic. So we see cuts to the EPA, to the State Department, to the Health and Human Services Department, to labor, to Department of Housing. It covers many things that most of us hold very near and dear. And then we see a big boost to the military and to building up his wall, $54 billion in increased spending on defense.
Now, I know it's been discussed widely that the Environmental Protection Agency has been targeted for some of the deepest cuts in this budget, and
yes,
there are proposed thousands of layoffs from the EPA, and also their budget was going to be substantially slashed. Are there other standout agencies that are on the chopping block that you would like to mention here, just in terms of the people on the other end of those budget cuts, if they went through, would be suffering? I mean, thinking about children, for instance, and some of the important children's programs that we hear about, Meals on Wheels, which is an essential service for senior citizens across this country. Just mention a few of those highlights, if it would help people kind of digest what the priority list here is of the Trump folks.
Yeah, well, I think you've just mentioned some of the most sort of sad and heartstring tugging examples. By the numbers, the EPA has the deepest cuts, 30% cuts. The Department of Agriculture has a 29% cut, which might be surprising to some. We'll see cuts of 15% to housing and urban development, which gets at some of those things that I was mentioning earlier, the affordable housing initiatives, neighborhood revitalization projects. The thing about this budget is it's very focused on measurable results. So programs that can't demonstrate really big performance outcomes are a lot of the ones that they say that they're cutting. So, for example, a job training program for seniors is being cut because a set of people don't finish it. And, they can't actually calculate how successfully it's putting people into employment because some people don't finish the program. So, it's just sort of turning people into numbers in a way that's, sad when you think about what these programs are actually for.
Now, Republicans have control of both houses of Congress, the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, as well as the White House now for the first time in many, many years. And it is more likely that a lot of the Trump proposed budget items may actually get through, given that they have this stranglehold on the government at the moment. And Democrats, although they oppose a lot of this budget, really are not controlling any levers of power in Washington these days. Given that set of facts, how is your group, Public Citizen and the Clean Budget Coalition, approaching opposition to this budget?
Definitely. Well, we've got a test case right now because while Trump's proposal was for next year, was for fiscal year 18, we have only, at this point, certainly less than a month. The money runs out from fiscal year 17 on April 28th. And so we've got a test to see how the GOP Congress funds the government when they could be faced with a shutdown and with, the obvious case that if the government shuts down, it will be their fault. They have control of both houses. So seeing what that causes, I think, will be our good test case for what will happen next year with the FY18 budget. So, will they be able to resist filling the budget up with ideological policy riders like trying to defund Planned Parenthood or do other inane things that they can't accomplish other ways? If they can resist, if they can keep the budget clean, then, we are more fearful for what might happen next year. But that discipline has been unusual amongst this caucus in the past. So it remains to be seen. And then, our tactics are simple: to explain to the American people that, this budget is they're being sold a bill of goods, to make sure that the Republicans feel some accountability for supporting things that are bad and unpopular with their constituents if they do so, and making it really clear that this is not what people voted for. So, whether we're talking about bad riders being attached or we're talking about the budget itself and inadequate funding for programs, people need to understand what they're voting for.
That was Lisa Gilbert, Vice President of Legislative Affairs with Public Citizen and Chair of the Clean Budget Coalition. Find more analysis on Trump's proposed budget and the groups fighting to defeat it by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A group of anti-pipeline activists just completed a 15-day, 200-mile walk across the North Carolina portion of the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which would also traverse West Virginia and Virginia, bringing more fracked natural gas through these three states. It's a project of Duke Energy and Dominion Resources, which the companies say will increase the gas supply in the Mid-Atlantic region. However, opponents have reasons to believe the gas will be exported. Anti-pipeline activists are concerned about threats to their air and water, to their property seized through eminent domain, and to increase risk of irreversible climate impacts. That's because the gas, which is composed of methane, contributes 100 times more warming to the atmosphere than an equal amount of carbon dioxide in the first decade after release. The Alliance to Protect Our People and the Places We Live launched its 200-mile walk with a rally on the Virginia border on March 4th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us excerpts from three speakers, beginning with Erica Faircloth, who identifies as a member of the 55,000-strong Lumbee tribe.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Erica, and I was given permission to be here today to give you a statement on behalf of the Coalition of Woodland Nations. The Coalition of Woodland Nations is asking all American Indian tribes and organizations in the United States and all indigenous people of the world to support our stand against the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. We are requesting proclamations, resolutions, and letters of support for the Coalition of Woodland Nations and in opposition to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. The Coalition of Woodland Indians was formed to unite all Native people in the protection of our environment, our traditions, our sacred sites, and areas of cultural and historical significance. The proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline is a 42-inch natural gas pipeline, which will carve an 8 to 12-foot deep trench and a 125-foot wide construction corridor through the Allegheny Highlands, the Blue Ridge Mountains, the foothills and Piedmont of Virginia, and on into the coastal plains and swamps of eastern North Carolina. This pipeline will directly affect the traditional lands of several tribes, including the Monacan, Chickahominy, the Eastern Chickahominy, the Nansemond, the Nottoway, the Okanichi, the Halawasaponi, the Maharan, the Tuscarora, the Goheri, and the Lumbee. This pipeline threatens sacred sites of the Monacan tribe in Virginia and the Tuscarora and Waccamaw peoples of North Carolina. Other undocumented sacred sites are also being threatened. The terminus is in Robeson County, North Carolina, home of the Lumbee tribe and one of the densest populations of American Indians on the East Coast. Thank you for your support, and no Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Thank you.
That was Erica Faircloth, an Indigenous resident who lives along the pipeline route. Another speaker was local property owner Valerie Williams.
We cannot separate. It's like the blood that runs through your veins. You can't separate that blood running through your veins. So we can't separate our ties to our farm because that's how dear it is to us. And for anybody who think any different, unless they don't have those ties, I don't understand how they can feel otherwise. But anyway, so I'm fighting this pipeline because I don't like what eminent domain is doing to our world today. I think enough has happened already, and that we need to conserve and preserve and protect some parts of our country. There are too many pipelines, too many places, and it's time to say no to these pipelines and yes to keeping our land, keeping our farmland, and doing what we desire to do with our properties.
That was local resident Valerie Williams. Marvin Winstead is a local farmer whose 70-acre property would be bisected by the proposed pipeline. He mentions FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the body in charge of evaluating interstate gas pipeline proposals.
Most of our members, a lot of them are senior citizens. In fact, a few of them are in the process of planning the transition of their estates to the next generation. And one reason they have joined our group and attended our meetings is this pipeline is causing so much disruption in what they're planning to do. And I wrote a little button here that says eminent domain abuse. That's what one of the big factors of this pipeline is. These companies, these corporate bullies, with their slick, polished presentations, and this is not their first rodeo. They've done this time and again in other parts of the country. It's well rehearsed for them. But that's what is going on. They are convincing the public. I've got over in my little briefcase there a newspaper article from a local paper. Our congressmen and senators have endorsed this, neglected, ignored, turned their backs on their constituents. They're in league with the companies, and that's what we've got to work. I'm so delighted to see so many people here today, and I hope you can help us get this message out to the public. A lot of my neighbors say, well, I'm sorry it's going across your property, but it's not on mine, it's not in my backyard, so it's not so much my problem. And what they don't realize is it is in their backyard. It may not literally be in their backyard today, but if this pipeline is built, it will be in their mailbox when they get their utility bill. They don't realize that this company will be able to build this project, approach the State Utilities Commission or FERC, and get rate increases to pay for it. Figure out 14% of $5 billion. That's what they stand to gain, to say nothing of all up to 2 billion cubic feet of gas per day that they move through it. It's really hard for us. We're small groups with limited resources, and these are big multinational companies that have got the financial resources and got the PR people to help get their message out. So if you can help us get the message out to the public, yes, it's a finite number of individuals who are directly impacted, but the general public at large is impacted as well. If you can help us get that message out, maybe we can achieve our goal of stopping this pipeline. Thank you so much for being here today.
That was anti-pipeline activists Marvin Winstead, Valerie Williams, and Erica Faircloth. Speaking at a March 4th rally in North Carolina, that kicked off a 200-mile protest walk. Learn more about opposition to the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A well-funded campaign by conservative groups calling for a constitutional convention to enact a balanced budget amendment has flown under the radar of most of America. Now the effort to convene such a convention under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution is within striking distance of gaining the required number of states to succeed. If only 6 more states sign on, proponents of a convention will have the 34 states needed to hold the first constitutional convention since the original convention of states drafted the U.S. Constitution in 1787. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, dozens of states adopted calls for an Article 5 convention to propose a balanced budget amendment, but concerns about the potential of a runaway convention led more than 12 states to rescind their endorsement of the effort. More recently, the state of New Mexico rescinded their original 1979 call for a convention due to the unpredictable direction of a new convention that could eliminate current constitutional rights and protections influenced by wealthy conservative and corporate interests. Although some progressive activists favor holding a convention to overturn the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling that opened up U.S. election campaigns to unlimited and unaccountable money in politics, the primary advocate for a convention has come from Republicans and right-wing special interest groups, including the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Your reporter spoke with Jay Reistenberg, campaigns and states media strategist with Common Cause, who explains why his group and others strongly oppose the effort to call a constitutional convention.
Under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, there's basically two ways to amend the Constitution. The first way, is which has always been used, is you get two-thirds of each chamber in Congress to pass an amendment, and then it goes to the states, and 38 states, or three-fourths of the states, has to ratify it. And throughout our 230-year constitutional history, that's always how we've been able to amend the Constitution. For about the last 50 years or so, there has been an effort underway by conservative groups who have been pushing for a new constitutional convention under the other way to amend the Constitution in Article 5. And that's when you can get two-thirds of the states or 34 state legislatures to call for a convention. And today, we're frighteningly close to getting to that as conservative groups such as the American Legislative Exchange Council, a corporate lobbying group that does a lot of its work in secret, now have, they claim, 28 states on the record calling for a convention. The problem with calling an Article 5 convention under for one reason, which is what most groups are doing, is that there's nothing in the Constitution saying that it only needs to be about one issue. So what that means is they call an Article 5 convention to enact a balanced budget amendment. Anything could be brought up, anything from restricting the First Amendment to repealing Supreme Court decisions around marriage equality and health care and immigration and abortion access to restricting privacy rights and voting rights. So in theory, under an Article 5 convention, everyone's constitutional rights and civil liberties could be up for grabs.
From my understanding, this is maybe the closest the nation has been to actually, in reality, calling one of these conventions.
So it takes 34 states to call a convention, or two-thirds of the states, which is 34. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, we were dangerously close, as we are now, with about 30 or 31 states. And all of a sudden, state legislatures realized that this was a really bad and dangerous idea. So states started to rescind them. And what we've seen over the last 10 years is a renewed effort by conservative groups, Koch-funded groups, Koch brother-funded groups, to start this process again. And so today, most people agree we're at 28 states, meaning only six states away from calling a convention. Now, that's scary on its face, but what's even scarier, and since this is being pushed by conservatives, mostly Republicans, is that there are currently eight Republican-controlled states that do not have a live application on the books. So the numbers are really in the special interest groups who are wanting to call a convention's favor.
Now, what is your organization or other groups that are opposed to convening such a convention doing to actually turn the tide in the other direction? And you might also mention the fact that the state of New Mexico has recently rescinded their original endorsement of such a convention.
Yeah, that's right. It was a great win. So what us and other groups, both on the right and the left, are doing we're educating the public and talking to lawmakers, and we're really seeing reaction from both Republicans and Democrats on how bad of an idea this is, and seeing bipartisan support to stopping this. So Common Cause is really focused on rescinding some of these older calls. You mentioned New Mexico. This was really a coalition-led effort by Common Cause and some other groups in New Mexico to rescind it, which is why we're at 28 versus 29. We were at 29 last week, and luckily New Mexico rescinded. We're looking to do similar things in Maryland, in Nevada, in Colorado. We did this last year in Delaware. Unfortunately, I think the numbers still are in the other side's favor. So we will definitely have to look at legal arguments we can make. A lot of these applications that they call live, including these 28 over passed in the 1970s and 1980s. So there's some legal questions on whether these applications are still valid.
That was Jay Reistenberg, campaigns and states media strategist with Common Cause. Find links to the group's Dangerous Path report and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Grateful Dread Public Radio in Nashville, Tennessee, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community radio stations across the U.S. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.